This is Publishing Talks, a podcast about the book industry. I'm David Wilk, your host, and today I'm talking to Jeffrey Leppendorf. He's the executive director of two organizations, CLMP, which is the Council of Literary Magazines and Presses, and SPD, which stands for Small Press Distribution. How are you, Jeffrey?
I'm terrific, David. Thanks for having me.
Oh, I'm really glad to have you here. I think you have a unique position. Not only do you run two organizations at once, which is an amazing feat, and that they have, you know, these two organizations have a unique relationship, but I think you're also in the position to have a view of independent publishing that probably no one else in the world can have. So I'm really hoping that you can illuminate me and the people who are listening. But maybe before we start talking about actual things, you could talk a little bit about you and your career, how you got into the role of running two important nonprofit organizations.
Well, that's I guess like anyone who has a career at some point in their lives discovers that there they are in a career. You know, gosh, who knows how exactly I got here. I'm a musician. My doctorate's in music composition, and I'm an ex-professor of music history. But I've always been a book junkie since the earliest days when I could read, long before discovering music, in fact. So it really is a first love. And for me, you know, it's a great privilege to work for two organizations that help others be able to better love what I love so much. So that's really what it is. But my main business background is in fundraising. So I guess that's the real kind of business route that got me to both these orgs, is the money management part. But that combined with, you know, me just loving what these two orgs do so very much, it's, you know, what got me there, you know, through a chain of fortunate, you know, mistakes. But I guess it is true that when you're with me, you're in two places at once, you know, at the very least. These are the two national not-for-profits that serve the community of independent literary publishers. And
right,
those are the publishers
actually,
that we think of as... Go ahead, sorry.
No, that's right. I was just going to say that, you know, CLMP has been serving... originally, it started as a magazine support organization in 1967,
right,
but expanded over the years to
cover
independent publishing. And SPD goes back to 1967 when, 69, and Peter Howard and Jack Shoemaker founded it as another support organization. Although I think at the very beginning, I'm not sure it was nonprofit, but SPD.
Right. Well, SPD, they both have funny backgrounds. Go ahead. Yeah, when SPD started, exactly right, Richard Howard and Shoemaker really started as a shop. It really was a store that some people still remember on San Pablo in North Berkeley in California. And that started doing events. And it all around independently produced books, you know, small published books. And the not-for-profit originally was really just for the reading series. And it then grew into what we now know as SPD, that primarily serves as an actual physical book distributor. There's a real warehouse in North Berkeley. And if anyone is visiting the Bay Area, they should certainly get out there and visit it. You can buy books from the warehouse. And it's a great treat to walk through the stacks there and find books you really probably had no idea existed. I love going there and buying books and all myself.
Right, SPD has and also does a catalog which is sent out to individuals. I mean, it has an unusual role because I think almost by necessity encompasses within it things that people in the publishing business have been talking about for years, and that is selling direct to consumer, selling at the same time to stores and libraries, and really not feeling like they're a competitor with their own customers, just because they're dealing with such a small universe ultimately that it's necessary for them to find every way possible to sell books.
That's right. I mean, our primary function at SPD, Small Press Distribution, and by the way, everyone should, if they haven't already, you know, should visit us at spdbooks.org, you know, the shop for books, and discover titles that they may not know about, is that we are not-for-profit. We're the only remaining not-for-profit distributor, I think, in the whole world. And there used to be others in the States, and they're all long gone. We're it. not-for-profit wise for independently produced literary books. And we are kind of a funny animal because we're not merely a distributor. A distributor, you know, as most of your listeners may know, is a middleman. You know, a distributor gets the books to the booksellers. They're in between the publisher and the bookseller. So a traditional distributor would get the books to a bookstore or to something like Amazon, even. And we do that as well. And we also get it to other kinds of middle people known as wholesalers and jobbers, who are folks who may sell to special groups like libraries. But we also work as a online bookstore as well. So that's really unusual. I don't know if too many other distributors, if any, really work as bookstores. So people
can buy none of them. None of them.
I think by definition, we're pretty much it. I don't want to make such a blanket, you know, statement without being absolutely sure, but it's certainly unusual, if not absolutely unique. And that's really something because the kind of books we distribute are so special and kind of focused in a way, you know, these independently produced literary titles, that once folks discover us, they're pretty happy to have, because we're not just even literary books, we're a kind of literary book, you know, to most folks. And so there are certain kinds of literary titles that once one discovers that they can get them through us, they're going to know where the first place to look, you know, poetry, speculative fiction, let's say culturally specific writing, a certain kind of political writing, work in translation, things like that. Your best first place to look is going to be at SPD. And it's true that we, in fact, also distribute our books to Amazon. And, you know, if people want to buy their books on Amazon, that's their choice, and that's why we do it, because our role is to make the books as available as possible. But it's best if they buy them through us because, quite simply put, more money will go to the writer and the publisher.
Right.
So it's a good reason.
And SPD has a what is called a strategic partnership relationship with CLMP. Is that correct?
Well, kind of. Yeah. If I am that partnership, then yes. The two orgs have a what's called a shared service agreement, and what is shared is me, essentially.
Got
so
it.
We've always had a strategic relationship. You know, I think everyone for years and years has who knows both of us has thought of SPD and CLMP as kind of a right arm and left arm, you know, of independent literary publishing as far as service organizations go. They've always symbiotically existed. And for years and years, I've thought about merging. And the reason we haven't fully merged, simply put, has to do with the way that funding works in this country. You know, most foundation funding is regional. And so if we merged, we would have to legally be in one place or the other, which means losing regional funding from either New York or from California, which
right.
we've been
both of, to. Right. Both of which are good states to be in, and neither it would not be good for you to lose one or the other.
Exactly. So. And we're very fortunate to have pretty, you know, healthy funding federally from the National Endowment for the Arts. And we each get, you know, funding from them. And if we merged, of course, we would only as one get funding, and it wouldn't be twice as much because we're both kind of at the cap there. So it's a simple reason why we haven't really merged. So we've kind of quasi-merged, and at this point, it's largely through me, but we'll do things together. There's a conference that many of our publishers go to, the American Writers and Writings Programs Conference, AWP. And for instance, at that conference, we have a joint membership meeting. And then we'll share information back and forth. So, you know, that's the main thing. There are also some differences, too. SPD is primarily a book distributor, and CLMP's largest part of our membership is literary magazines, which is a whole other world.
Right, and you're not and CLMP, of course, is not a distributor of magazines,
of course.
But you are a support organization. You provide funding and technical service, I think, to your members.
Right, we're primarily what's called a technical assistance provider, and that's a mystery word to most people, but it just means we're a how-to organization. We teach folks how-to, and we advocate on their behalf, and we also help facilitate a lot of communication amongst small publishers so they don't have to reinvent the wheel. You know, look, none of them are competitors. As Richard Nash, who's now the publisher of Red Lemonade, used to be at Softcult for years, likes to say, you know, your competitors aren't other publishers. They are Xbox and movies, 3D movies. So that's true. So we all want people to read. We all want people to read good books. And, you know, we all love what we do. So it's a really supportive, mutually supportive community, and we help facilitate that mutual support. So we have all kinds of gatherings where publishers can share information virtually, you know, and in person. And we also have a few very small granting programs. Back in the 80s, we did actually give away a lot of money. We're not primarily a grantor or a re-grantor. That's a very, very small part of what we do. We do a little bit of that. But mostly we're here to get information to folks, teach them how to do things, find the answers that they have, and also facilitate relationships between independent literary publishing and larger publishing, which again is not the enemy of small publishing. It's not us and them. You know, it's a matter of appropriateness and scale. So certain kinds of books are better published by a giant conglomerate, and other kinds of books are much better published by a small independent publisher.
So could you talk a little bit? I think the thing that I'm interested in, you know, for the kind of conversation for today is to talk about the role of it. I sort of feel like over the last few years that as the independent bookstores have gone away and as bricks and mortar retail has changed.
Yeah.
And become more limited to, let's say, one major retailer taking most of the space. And there, you know, what we've lost is a certain amount of variety of retail, which I think has also affected the way that independent publishing is able to be found and to be seen in the world. You know, aside there are other things that I think have affected independent publishing too, and that is the huge rise in self-publishing through now more accepted tools like Lulu and Blurb and CreateSpace and iUniverse, and I want to talk about that too.
Sure.
But I'm sort of interested in your view because you're at the helm of, you know, you're kind of in this place where you're able to see what is happening to so many different independent publishers and as well literary magazines who are also affected by the change in retail.
Yeah.
Or in the change in, and also many of whom have moved to digital as a result very rapidly, have said, well, what do I need to keep printing magazines for? Maybe I can just do this digitally much more effectively. And a number of magazines have simply abandoned print. So I'm
right.
Kind of interested in your sense. So I'll ask some specific questions. Do you feel that, and we'll separate it for books and magazines.
Okay.
But from the magazine perspective, do you feel over the last, let's say, 5 years, is it true that there are fewer literary magazines publishing in print than there were, let's say, 20 or 25 years ago, maybe 30 years ago, which was a kind of golden, in some ways, just an overwhelmingly active period? I'm not sure it would be golden, but I tend to think of it
sure.
as a period when it was possible to create a magazine virtually with a literary magazine with not very much money and find a way of getting it out to people and exist in an ecosystem that no longer exists. So long predication to say is my sense that this is really moving into digital correct?
Well, it's an interesting time. Not really. The fact is there are even more print magazines now than there were 20 years ago. But there are also many, many online, when we say online, I mean, we're talking about online only, you know, not a
yes.
digital presence of a print magazine, but, our largest growing group is absolutely digital only. Because as you say, it's a way you can, with very little overhead, maybe even no overhead if you have a server set up, one can put out a beautiful, you know, quality publication that can reach folks around the world, you know, presto, without printing a thing. So, again, potentially, you still have to do it, but we have more and more...
You still have the challenge then of marketing,
exactly.
of being found. All
the readers
the things
still have
that,
to find you. Yeah, a
right,
couple things have happened in the past few years. I mean, one is that there was a kind of golden age, and it's still there. That definitely has maybe its passing, which is the college university supported magazine.
Mm-hmm.
Those definitely are waning a little bit. There are some that are around and they be around, you know, for many, many, many years that are wonderful magazines. You know, like one excellent example is Canyon Review. You know, it's a spectacularly wonderful magazine at Canyon College. They also have a great online presence, which has separate content. They've really done it right. You know, I don't see them going away. And it's a print, you know, publication largely. But there are a lot of other college university affiliated magazines that were threatened over the past very recent years because, look, you know, universities, as we all know right now, and colleges have been financially threatened. Academia is also at a, like big publishing, it finds itself at a kind of critical financial juncture and has to rethink the way it's been doing things for a number of years. And one of the first things that's been cut in a lot of academic institutions has been their magazines. You know, they haven't necessarily valued them as the beautiful crowns, you know, that they should be or that they are. And I think this has been double-edged. I have to say that, you know, there have been a lot of great magazines that were supported by academic institutions, and, you know, they maybe were great, but that doesn't mean they had really a whole lot of readers because they were fully supported and they weren't forced to kind of do the work of having to get out there. And in some ways, it's been, some of the magazine publishers would hate me, but I think it's been good for them to be forced to have to go out and find money elsewhere to support themselves because, you know, it's not enough to have a great product. It has to be in a reader's hands. We always like to say, I always like to remind people that to publish literally means to make public. And so what we say at SPD and CLMT is, as far as we're concerned, until a book or a magazine reaches a reader's hands, it hasn't been published. It's merely been printed. And, you know, publishing isn't printing. Printing is a mechanical thing that happens as one part, perhaps, of publishing. These days, that doesn't even have to be part of it. But it's really the marketing and the distribution is the publishing. It's half the publishing. The editing and the acquisition is the other half. So that's the, you know, the mysterious part that I think most readers don't really think about. I think they probably think it's the mechanical part. It really isn't. So digital is a great, inexpensive way to produce a magazine, but then you still have to get it out there, right? And you were speaking earlier about the challenges to being an independent bookseller, and there's still a natural relationship between indie bookselling and indie publishing, of course, but it is true there are, you know, fewer indie bookstores, and that whole idea of browsing is one that all the big publishers and the online retailers are, you know, desperately trying to find a replacement for, and right now they're really isn't real browsing online. It's the illusion of browsing, but really isn't. There isn't that just walking around a store and seeing if a cover catches your eye. You know, things are recommended based on past purchases or there are lists and things like that, but that's not simply browsing. The fact that most of the SPD catalog is in fact available through Amazon doesn't mean you can find those books unless you know what they are already.
That's correct. No, I think that the corollary to browse is commonly thought of and described as discoverability.
Exactly.
And that is, you know, but I think that there's a problem there, and that is the, it kind of runs counter to the way people have, browsing existed because it served a need. It wasn't necessarily the need only of the seller. It actually served a need of the buyer as well. That's, you know, anything successful that happens in retail or, you know, in the relationship between buying and selling is usually because it works for the customer, not because it works for the seller.
Exactly.
So,
exactly.
You know, we have a problem, and that is especially, I think, for the less well-known independent authors, independent publishers, independent literary magazines who don't have automatic name recognition. They're not going to pop up in a lot of searches as kind of, you know, if you like this, then you might like that. Right. There does seem to be an ongoing trend in digital selling to accrue more bestsellers to a smaller number of, you know, smaller number of titles,
right,
so that you see these big monster mega hits and everybody else is completely invisible. So,
right,
you know, that's a big challenge. It's a big challenge for publishers, large publishers who have lots of money,
right,
and it's or a lot more money, let's say. They may not have lots of money.
Well,
but,
comparatively, yeah. Well, the funny
right.
thing is that it is a challenge for them, and it's actually created a funny situation right now, and I would say an opportunity, and it's why we're at this really right now a beautiful moment for small publishers to be reaching more people. You know, the big houses who are faced now with serious economic challenges, let's say that there was a certain level of, you know, fat to be trimmed just a short while ago, and they've had a really, you know, lop off big budget items, and they're forced economically to publish books. They're probably going to appeal to larger audiences because they need those sales. And that's fine for certain kinds of books. They're all working really hard to do two things. One is to crack this nut of, you know, discoverability, like you were talking about. And the other word that big six, the big conglomerate publishers like to use, is this idea of developing vertical marketplaces, quote unquote. And a vertical marketplace is a fancy word for a focused customer base. Now, the fact is, what small press publishers have been doing since the beginning of small press publishing is developing vertical marketplaces, which is to say, a small press is usually one person's taste or a couple of people. It's a really focused sensibility. You know, you buy a book from Archipelago Press, and you've told me you've read three books from Archipelago Press. I know right away, without even asking, you're someone who is interested in work and translation. Right? You buy things from Copper Canyon Press, I know you're a poetry reader. I don't even have to ask what you read, because those presses are so focused that, you know, right away we know. If you've read two or three books and you recognize that as a brand, then it's meaningful to you. If you read a book by a big publisher, the brand might say to you, this is probably of a certain quality, perhaps. But beyond that, I have no idea. I would have to ask you, was it a cookbook? Was it a novel? Was it a children's book? Was it Sudoku puzzles? You know, it could be anything. So they're all scrambling to look like they're little. And so the little guys already are little and focused, and they've always published things that are based on a mission. They're mission-driven. That's the important thing to us. Most are not-for-profit, not all of them are, but they're all mission-driven to publish what they publish. What that means really is there's a sensibility there that's really clear. It's a brand, a meaningful brand. It's not artificial. You know, it wasn't based on market research. It's based on publishing what one or two or three people just really care about in a focused way and sticking to their guns, you know, and hoping there are other people who care about that kind of book too. And publishing in smaller print runs. This is for magazines and books, you know, smaller print runs. And the need to sell so many is less, smaller. And so success can be defined on a smaller level, and it can keep being repeated. On the other hand, also good, they can experiment with things. And if something doesn't work, well, you know, not such a big deal. A big house can't suddenly try some new wacky digital thing. And if it fails, you know, if we're talking hundreds of thousands of dollars, perhaps.
There's another advantage that goes with what you just said that I think is actually profound, and I hadn't really thought about it before this, and that is there's a huge difference between being an employee and being the entrepreneurial developer of an institution or an organization. So if you create a small press or a magazine, it's you. It's your vision, as you said, the singular vision of the founder often, and you are more committed to it than anybody else will be. The people who work in big publishing companies, no matter how good they are, and a lot of them are brilliant and really dedicated, smart, wonderful people, they clock out at a certain point. They're not they may not be thinking about their business 24 hours a day the way most founders will.
That's right. I mean, many small publishers, it really is their own, you know, checkbook. And the publishing house might really be their kitchen. But there's more to it than that, too. There are very caring, highly literate, beautifully curatorially, you know, nuanced editors working at big houses who really care about literature. But there are other people making decisions. And so an editor in a large house may find a high literary book or a book of great literary merit and really love it and want to put everything they can behind it. But the marketing department may feel otherwise. And, you know, that's part of the decision-making process. And the publisher on top of that may feel otherwise and so forth. And the reps may feel otherwise. And, you know, there are many, many, many people involved, more people. And so when a book is published by a smaller house, it doesn't mean it's better. It doesn't mean it's worse. But it means that it can have potentially a more focused audience and be excellent. Whereas a book that is excellent that potentially has a small audience gets to a big house, they generally will have to reject it because they can't afford to put the money behind it and not have it sell at a larger quantity. So, you know, it's simple math.
Could you give a couple of examples, either of magazines or of independent book publishers, who you feel over the last few years have made a big impact by, or have made the leap to digital marketing that has enabled them to be much more successful than they had been in the past, or to start and be able to be successful without knowing whether they would have done better in the past. Just to, as good examples of people who have been really good at this.
Sure. But actually, before even answering that, I want to back up to one other thing, which is that even digital aside, the economic crisis, that we've all had to face over the past recent years has also been a benefit to smaller publishers in a maybe non-intuitive way, which is simply this. Talk about books, at least, specifically. It used to be that, let's talk about fiction. Work that would be represented by an agent would first be pitched to people at a big house because those are the folks that could possibly give a big advance, which is how an agent and an author are going to make money. And a small publisher could never give as much money. And so small publishers were traditionally the last resort of literary agents. Even though they might, many of us would say, do a better job of the publishing, they certainly couldn't pay as much up front, right? So these days, things have changed. So, a small press, like, say, Grey Wolf Press or Bellevue Literary Press, their advance could, say, for a first novel, be as much as what a big house can offer these days. Or it's a book that before might have gotten a nice advance from a big house, but, it's a work that might have been a little riskier for a big house to take on. They simply might not take it on now, and it will just go to a smaller house. And a literary agent would be thrilled for it to be published by, say, Grey Wolf Press or a Bellevue Literary Press. And in fact, look at those two, as two examples, in the past couple of years have pulled all sorts of major awards. The awards that traditionally had been going to the books published by the big six publishers. And so there's been a shift, in quality, a larger amount of that work that was edgier a little bit, but still somewhat focused that would have gone to big house has been going to smaller independent publishers more recently. So it's no longer the last resort. It's been a first choice for many editors and publishers. They would be thrilled to get with one of those houses. And as far as digital marketing, a lot of our folks can try things. And again, as I said, less risk equals less risk. So if they try something and it fails, they just try something else. Whereas a big house really has to be very careful about how it's going to invest its money in these digital domains. And speaking of magazines in particular, we have a whole slew of new publishers who are online only and are doing amazing things. Electric literature, narrative, triple canopy. I mean, I could go on and on and on of magazines that are online only and are spectacular. Look amazing. And also, magazines that were traditionally in print, like I mentioned, Kenyon Review before, that have a unique online presence where it's not simply an ad for the magazine being the print thing, but the online, Kenyon Review Online is a unique publication. It's wonderful.
Well, so is there let's say I was a person who was listening to you right now and heard you talk about electric literature and said, well, what about is there a place where I can go and find out about all of these magazines? Where would you send
Yeah.
them?
Well, there are two places, and one is clmp.org. There's an online directory. It's free. You can search by genre. You could search just for online-only fiction, for example. And then the other place to look for books would be spdbooks.org, where, of course, you can also find lists of. We have done some of those things that you can find in other places as well, but focused on literature. So there are staff recommendations, kind of like a bookstore, and there are genre lists, and you could look just at, new poetry or gay and lesbian literature or, et cetera, on and on, just the e-books that we have available. And those are great places probably to start because they
And
both have good search engines.
no, I think those are two really good ideas, in fact. And what about have do you know much of, or have you heard of any magazines in independent literary magazines creating apps? Again, this is another whole ongoing discussion in the book and digital media industries, whether it's better to be in the app store or should you be, in the newsstand on the iPad or in the Amazon ecosystem, which is
Got it.
better?
Well, there are two different issues to think about. Let's talk about magazines because there is kind of special animal, because they're the book that keeps being published, right? The serial.
Right.
And
exactly.
Just a few years ago, I mean, we were all trying to come up with affordable ways for magazines to develop apps. And a few of them do have great apps, I should say. But more lately, most of us have not been pushing for apps. The challenge of an app is that, first of all, you've got to get everyone to know that it exists, just like selling a book, and get it. And then it takes an awful lot of work to keep people involved with an app. And the second, the novelty of the app has gone away, which could happen in 10 minutes, you know, to go back to it takes an awful lot of work again to get people to go back. So apps are very, very expensive to develop. And, you know, they can be buggy and they're hard to get them to go right. And then once they do exist, again, one is never going to discover it in the Apple App Store unless there's something outside of it that has sent you there. Because, again, browsing doesn't work so well there, as you may know if you've been looking for things. So, you know, a few people are going to the App Store and typing in literary magazine, I don't think. And I'm not sure it even comes up then. So other magazines have been dealing with other kind of ways of digital distribution. And so more and more literary magazines are available, say, through Kindle or through other e-readers. The problem there also, though, is that each e-reader is its own challenge. So having a magazine available through Kindle means that it's only available through Amazon, right? It doesn't mean it's available through a Sony Reader or a Nook or any of the other ones. So, you know, it takes a lot of work to get those things in those devices. And right now, you know, most magazines, if they are doing that, will probably start with Kindle because Amazon has such a large part of the marketplace. And, you know, you start with all marketing is kind of a target and you start in the middle, so you can't do everything. So that's, you know, unfortunate. And reinforces that kind of, you know, monopoly there, if it is. And other magazines are trying to find other ways. So some will simply be available online or online with a password to subscribers. A lot of magazines are working on ways to be available through tablets as more and more people are, you know, utilizing tablets to read. And that has, you know, different kinds of challenges, but also opportunities again, because of course, once you're on a tablet, as opposed to say a regular black and white Kindle, you can have sound, you know, you can click on the poem and hear the poet read it. Perhaps you can have video as well, along with the literary material. You can have interviews with the author, or, you know, it can be all sorts of ancillary other things that people are playing with. So that's a great thing. But that's an area that's really, I would say, still pretty young and just being developed by a few. But some of the folks are doing really remarkable things with it. Largely, though, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, it's the challenge of what you're talking about. I've been thinking about this lately, and that is this idea of fragmentation versus single market. I mean, you know, if you thought of the printed magazine or the printed book, could be sold anywhere to anyone. You could sell it on a newsstand. You could sell it in a catalog. You could sell it in through an ad. In other words, there's no real differentiation. You didn't have to own anything special in
That's
order
right.
to read it. And now we have this situation, which I think is challenging to all publishers, and that is, and worse, if you know, people have compared VHS to Betamax. Well, this is way worse,
right, exactly.
because they
oh,
only
way,
had
way
two
worse.
Formats.
That's right.
We have, you know, we have really multiple formats and multiple locked-in ecosystems, which, as you mentioned, Amazon has theirs, Barnes & Noble has theirs, Apple has theirs, you know, then there's Kobo, and I mean, if you want to try to be in all platforms so that, I mean, you have an obligation. Part of what you were saying at the very beginning is this idea that your goal is to make something available so that it can be sold to an actual reader.
Right.
And if you're, what if, you know, you say, okay, I don't have enough resources. I cannot make my magazine available on all of these platforms. You know, what am I going to do? You'll choose the one that has the most readers, and you may go to the Apple or the iPad
right.
because there are more iPads out there than anything else. But not everybody owns an iPad, so
yeah, it's a funny thing that, you know, we all have this assumption. I think generally that you know, when the internet became ubiquitous, it was introduced. It's really the great leveler. You know, anyone can be there on the internet. Anyone can make a website, and if you have the right stuff on it, you're equal to the website of a major corporation. You know, you can be. There's nothing keeping you from doing that. Whereas as opposed to literary content, let's say, as opposed to a physical bookstore, where if it was part of a large chain, a lot of readers don't know this, but in a Barnes & Noble store, those books that are on the front tables, may not be the books that were really chosen by the staff as their favorite books. They might be books that publishers have paid what's called co-op. They've actually bought real estate to make sure that those books are out in front. And, you know, the internet doesn't work that way. Anyone can make a website. You know, again, people have to discover it, but anyone can make a website. There are a few different things that are a little counterintuitive. One is that I can tell you that despite this real problem, which is that all this digital stuff gives the illusion of making things more available to people. In many ways, it really, to many people, makes things less available because some books are only available on device A and not device B. And if you own device A or device B, you may not be able to get what's on the other one. And so suddenly we all have access to less, depending on what we own, you know, or know how to maneuver. But on the other hand, something curious has happened too. You know, just a few years ago at SPD, we would sit around and think like, gosh, what is it going to mean to have a warehouse in 5 years? Should we be looking at smaller office space because everything's going to be virtual soon? And much to our surprise, initially, but now not, is that our print sales are up. We're selling more physical books than ever before. At the same time that we are also developing the ability to offer, you know, digital books and are offering some e-books. But there are a few different reasons perhaps for that. It might be that the readers of certain kinds of literature are different kinds of readers. Maybe they're slow adopters. Maybe they're Luddites. I don't know. But a lot of books that we sell to do seem to cherish the printed object a little more than general readers might. The other is that a lot of what we do distribute includes poetry. And right now, so far, digital publishing is fairly unfriendly to poetry. You know, it all works like HTML, where things look different on different browsers and so forth. And poetry is very, very frequently very tied to its typesetting. And when that typesetting is malleable, there's a problem because it can destroy the poetry depending on what it is. And
yeah, so, no, I think that's,
you know,
true.
It's a problem. So for our readers, they don't seem to want it yet. To be honest, I think there will be a conversion. I really do, but you know, we might be one of the last warehouses standing.
Well, there is this sense also that digital objects are invisible, and they don't have real value to us. You know, we consume them, but they're not objectified by nature. And some people are perfectly happy to live in a completely digital world, but I think that many, many people still feel that if it's not visible, it's not as real. And so there is still this idea that, and especially true, I think, as the world becomes more and more digital in terms of consumption of literature and culture, the cultural objects become more valuable
when they are real. Yeah.
And so
we think of literature as something permanent. You know, a valuable piece of literature is always a valuable piece of literature. It's not topical. I mean, it may be topical, but it's not merely topical.
Think about what happened in the storm that we all just went through. If you didn't have electricity, you could not ultimately access the, you know, let's say all of your ebooks were in the cloud and you wanted to read to feel better today. I wanted to read, you know, a book that I had bought digitally. If I don't have access to the internet or if my reader is run out of electricity, I don't have access to what I own, essentially, or feel I own.
Yeah.
But the book is always on my shelf, of course, unless it gets wet and gets washed away.
Right. Well, look, for many of us, and I don't think this is a matter of simply being a Luddite, and I should say, look, I own multiple e-readers, and I love them, actually. I buy a lot of books on them. I also I have found, since owning them, even more print books. It simply resulted in me buying even more books. There are some books I read digitally, some books I want to read in print, some I read both ways. And it turns out, research is now showing that I'm a typical reader, actually. Most people that own e-readers, there is almost never a full conversion. It's simply another way to read. You know, readers are readers, and they want to read in as many ways as possible. And I may read on my iPhone while waiting in line, and I do, you know, at a store. But I also want to curl up with a physical book, you know, at home. That's beautifully bound and typeset, and that isn't going to change and won't go away if the power goes away. When you buy an ebook, you know, you're not really buying a book, you're buying the right to read the book on your device. And for many people, they do want to own it. For many of us, and this might change generationally, but being able to see books we've read on a bookshelf is not merely an act of nostalgia, but we really do go back and pull those books off the shelf again. And also, look, if we've been reading on a Kindle for years and decide, well, you know what, I think I'm going to switch to the Nook now, I suddenly don't own all of my books. I don't have access to them because the license for me to read them was only through Kindle. So that's a problem that probably what's going to have to change in coming years. You know, a lot of the way that we read digitally is not the way it will be. And whether it ends up being a Betamax, you know, VHS situation where the best solution isn't the one we end up with, I don't know. But right now is not the way it can possibly be in even a few years. The idea of not owning what you've bought has to change. One thing that might even change is, you know, maybe we'll stop buying these objects altogether and we'll simply pay for access. That would be the radical other extreme. One pays a monthly fee and has access to anything, you know, available on a Kindle or a Nook or an iPad. And that's just the way it is, like Spotify or any of those music services.
Right. And if you did that for small press distribution for all of those independent publishers, I would be right there.
and at such time that they're all available digitally, maybe that will happen. Maybe we'll do that. For now, again, you know, most of them, more and more of our publishers are simultaneously, you know, producing new books as digitally and in print. And a lot of them are going back to some of their backlist and making them available digitally. But the majority of them still, and again, a lot of it is this poetry problem. A lot of them are simply not available digitally at all, you know, for real practical reasons.
Well, and that I think that actually will change over the next few years because, yeah, as you said, we're still in flux. The ebook is really at its, you know, very early stage. You know, as some years go by, assuming that we're still on a trajectory to see growth in ebook publishing, I think you'll see, you know, a fixed page layout will become more common. Poetry will be a lot easier to handle.
Sure.
I think it'll, you know, and there'll be more and more interest in as more and more people are looking for digital products. I think it will increase the ease in with which you'll be able to produce and then publish and there and then promote a wider range of books.
I think so too, and I like to think that a lot of the smaller publishers, the sort of smaller, groupier, more experimental publishers, I think they'll be some of the first to really do great things with the technology. Which is to say that right now we're in an age of or period of thinking about conversion. You know, we think of them as digital versions of a print book. You know, the digital is kind of a version of, as opposed to anything. And, you know, now there is the possibility of what publishing folks call enhanced e-books, which is just a fancy way of saying a book that has sound or images in it. And I would like to think that more and more folks will start, starting with writers, really, will think in terms of producing, let's call them books, digital objects, you know, literary objects that utilize these other possibilities as intrinsic parts of the work of literature. Or even on the simplest level, that, you know, when there's a digital book out there, you can include things like an interview with the author on video that I think a lot of writers might like, or an audio of the poet reading the poems along with the printed book in a digital format. So as we start leaving this transitionary period of conversion or digital version of, and start entering a true digital publishing era, which we have not really reached yet, except for individual titles, you know, it's going to be exciting to see what happens.
No, I agree completely. Well, really, Jeffrey, we could go on and on, but I think it's we've reached the ending point here. So I wanted to really thank you for spending so much time and for being so eloquent in behalf of independent publishing, both books and magazines. Really appreciate you taking the time. This is David Wilk. I've been talking to Jeffrey Leppendorf, the Executive Director of Small Press Distribution and the Council of Literary Magazines and Publishers. And this is Publishing Talks. Thank you so much.